Chapter 7. The Angles and Saxons in the Middle Ages. From the time of the first permanent hold of the Jutes, the Saxons, and the Angles on British soil until they really possessed the land was about 150 years. The Jutes possessed Kent. These were the fewest of the three peoples, and therefore occupied the smallest portion of the land. Their dominions took in only Kent, with perhaps, for a while, Surrey, and the Isle of Wight, with a small part of the neighboring mainland of Hampshire, and the kingdom of the Jutes never permanently outgrew the bounds of their earliest conquests. On all sides of the Jutes landward dwelt the Saxons. South and west were the South Saxons, from whom the land held by them derived the abbreviated name Sussex, and from that Sussex, which it has ever since borne. West of these, but more inland, dwelt the West Saxons, whose kingdom was called Wessex. North of Kent dwelt the East Saxons, their kingdom and land called forever Essex. And between the East Saxons and the West Saxons, between Essex and Wessex, dwelt the Middle Saxons, their kingdom and land called forever Middlesex. The Angles held all the land north of Essex, Middlesex, and Wessex to the Firth of Forth. In the peninsula immediately north of Essex dwelt the East Angles, their kingdom and country called East Anglia. Those in the northern part of the peninsula were called Northfolk, and those in the southern part Southfolk, from which the descent through Norfolk and Southfolk come the names that still remain, Norfolk and Suffolk. West of these dwelt the South Angles, immediately north of these the Mid-Angles reaching to the river Humber. From the Humber to the Firth of Forth the land was divided by the Angles into two almost equal portions, the southern of which was the kingdom of Deira, and the northern the kingdom of Bernicia. The territory between Wales and Mid and South Anglia, being the border, was at first a mark or march, from which it became Marcia and Mercia. Its Anglican inhabitants were called Mercians, and their kingdom Mercia, which also included the Mid and South Angles. The kingdom of the Jutes was established in Kent in AD 475, that of the South Saxons in 491, that of the West Saxons in 519, that of the East Saxons about 525, and by 552, the Angles had made the conquest of their part of Middle Britain to the march or border. This pressure of the Angles in Mid-Britain enabled the South Saxons to push their conquests further inland. In 552, their capture of the hill fort of Old Sarum threw open the reaches of the Wiltshire Downs, and a march of King Cuthwulf on the Thames made them masters in 571 of the districts which now form Oxfordshire and Berkshire. Pushing along the upper valley of Avon to a new battle of Barbary Hill, they swooped at last from their uplands on the rich prey that lay along the Severn. Gloucester, Cirencester, and Bath, cities which had leagued under their British kings to resist this onset, became in 577 the spoil of an English victory at Deorum, and the line of the great western river lay open to the arms of the conquerors. With the victory of Deorum, the conquest of the bulk of Britain was complete. Eastward of a line which may be roughly drawn along the moorlands of Northumberland and Yorkshire, through Derbyshire and the Forest of Arden to the Lower Severn, and thence by Mendip to the sea, the island had passed into English hands. Britain had in the main become England, and within this new England a Teutonic society was settled on the wreck of Rome. So far as the conquest had yet gone, it had been complete. Not a Briton remained as subject or slave on English ground. Sullenly, inch by inch, the beaten men drew back from the land which their conquerors had won, and eastward of a border line which the English sword had drawn, all was now purely English. It is this which distinguishes the conquest of Britain from that of the other provinces of Rome. The conquest of Gaul by the Franks, or of Italy by the Lombards, proved little more than a forcible settlement of the one or the other among tributary subjects who were destined in the long course of ages to absorb their conquerors. French is the tongue not of the Frank, but of the Gaul whom he overcame, and the fair hair of the Lombard is all but unknown in Lombardy. But the English conquest of Britain up to the point which we have reached was a sheer dispossession of the people whom the English conquered. It was not that Englishmen, fierce and cruel as at times they seem to have been, were more fierce or more cruel than other Germans who attacked the empire. What really made the difference between the fate of Britain and that of the rest of the Roman world was the stubborn courage of the British themselves. In all the worldwide struggles between Rome and the German peoples, no land was so stubbornly fought for or so hardly won. In Gaul, no native resistance met Frank or Visigoth, save from the brave peasants of Brittany and Auvergne. No popular revolt broke out against the rule of Odoacer or Theodoric in Italy. But in Britain, the invader was met by a courage almost equal to his own. Instead of quartering themselves quietly, like their fellows abroad, on subjects who were glad to buy peace by obedience and tribute, the English had to make every inch of Britain their own by hard fighting. What strikes us at once in the New England is this, that it was the one purely German nation that rose upon the wreck of Rome. In other lands, in Spain or Gaul or Italy, though they were equally conquered by German peoples, religion, social life, administrative order still remained Roman. Britain was almost the only province of the empire where Rome died into a vague tradition of the past. The whole organization of government and society disappeared with the people who used it. The settlement of the English in the conquered land was nothing less than an absolute transfer of English society in its completest form to the soil of Britain. The slowness of their advance, the small numbers of each separate band in its descent upon the coast, made it possible for the settlers to bring with them, or to call to them when their work was done, the wives and children, the late enslaved, even the cattle they had left behind them. The first wave of conquest was but the prelude to the gradual migration of a whole people. It was England which settled down on British soil, England with its own language, its own laws, its complete social fabric, its system of village life and village culture, its township and its hundred, its principle of kinship, its principle of representation. It was not as mere pirates or stray war bands, but as peoples already made and fitted by a common temper and common customs to draw together into our English nation in the days to come that our fathers left their homeland. Of the three peoples, the Jutes, the Saxons, and the Angles occupied a much larger portion of the land than did both the others, and so their name gave a new name to the land to which they had come, Angleland, Ingleland, England. While, as to the kingdom itself, it was Wessex that grew into England and her house of Cerdic that became the royal house over the whole land. However, this matter of one royal house over the whole land is another long story in addition to that of these three peoples taking possession of the land. For though all spoke the same language and used the same laws, and though all were bent on winning the same land, each band and each leader preferred their own separate course of action to any collective enterprise. This spirit caused them, though only three distinct peoples, to form themselves in the occupancy of the land into no less than eight distinct kingdoms. And no sooner were ended their wars with the Britons, that they might in quietness inhabit the land, than they began as desperate a struggle among themselves for the supremacy and the sole kingship of all England. Thus, in AD 597, there were in England the 8 distinct kingdoms of Wessex, Sussex, Kent, Essex, Mercia, East Anglia, Deira, and Bernicia. Each kingdom was the result of the union of smaller divisions called shires, their chiefs bearing the title of ealdorman or alderman in peace, of heritoga or herzog in time of war. The union of shires formed a reis or kingdom. The chief of the group thus formed was a signing or king. What, it may be asked, was the difference between king and ealdorman? The ealdorman was a ruler in peace and a captain in war. The king was more. Among the English, at least, the kingly houses all claimed descent from the blood of the gods. Every king was a son of Woden. A vague religious reverence thus gathered round the king in which the ealdorman had no share. He was also the head of the highest political aggregate which the ideas of those days had reached. He was, as the name implies, the head of the kin, the nation. The rule of the ealdorman was tribal and merely earthly. The rule of the king was national, and in some sort divine. Of the community, there were three classes: earls, churls, and thralls. The earls were a class who by distinction of birth were held to be entitled to special respect and honor, and who, because of this, possessed certain political privileges. The churls were freemen, but had no honors or privileges above those of the general community. The thralls were slaves held in bondage or thraldom. The earl, the churl, and the thrall are found everywhere. They are taken for granted, and legend represented the three classes as called into being by separate acts of the creative power of the gods. In AD 605, Æthelfrith, king of Bernicia, seized the kingdom of Deira, and as this gave them to all East Britain north of the river Humber, the enlarged kingdom thus formed was called Northumbria. Æthelfrith also made the complete conquest of the greater part of the land that was yet held by the Britons westward to the Irish Sea between the Firth of Clyde and the mouths of the Mersey and the Dee. This reduced the number of English kingdoms to 7, and it is this that is the ground upon which writers treat the history of that time under the title of the Saxon Heptarchy. When Æthelfrith seized Deira, Edwin, its rightful king, being but a child, fled to East Anglia, where he was protected by King Radwald. This served Æthelfrith as a pretext for an attempt to subdue that kingdom. He was vigorously resisted, and at the river Idle by Retford, he was defeated and slain. Upon the death of Æthelfrith, the people of Deira were glad to have Edwin return to his kingdom. By the conquest of Bernicia, Edwin reestablished and made permanent the union of Bernicia and Deira that Æthelfrith had formed. The greatness of Northumbria now reached its height. Within his own dominions, Edwin displayed a genius for civil government, which shows how utterly the mere age of conquest had passed away. With him began the English proverb so often applied to after kings: a woman with her babe might walk scatheless from sea to sea in Edwin's day. Peaceful communication revived along the deserted highways. The springs by the roadside were marked with stakes, and a cup of brass was set beside each for the traveler's refreshment. The Northumbrian king became, in fact, supreme over Britain, as no king of English blood had been before. Northward his kingdom reached to the Firth of Forth, and here, if we may trust tradition, Edwin formed a city which bore his name, Edinburgh, Edwin's Burg. To the west, his arms crushed the long resistance of Elmet, the district about Leeds. He was master of Chester, and the fleet he equipped there subdued the Isles of Anglesey and Man. South of the Umbria, he was owned as overlord by the 5 English states of Mid-Britain. The West Saxons remained for a while independent, but they, too, were at last obliged to acknowledge the overlordship of Northumbria. And Kent had bound itself to him by giving him its king's daughter as a wife, a step which probably marked political subordination. At this time, Penda was king of Mercia, and the other kingdoms of Mid-Britain recognized his overlordship, as he in turn recognized the overlordship of Edwin. In 633, Penda formed an alliance with a Welsh king, Cadwallon, to break the power of Edwin. The armies met in 633 at a place called Hathfeld, and in the fight, Edwin was defeated and slain. Bernicia at once seized on the fall of Edwin to recall the line of Æthelfrith to its throne, and after a year of anarchy, his second son, Oswald, became its king. The Welsh had remained encamped in the heart of the north, and Oswald's first fight was with Cadwallon. The forces met in 635 near the Roman wall. Cadwallon fell fighting on the Heaven's Field, as after times called the field of battle. The submission of the kingdom of Deira to the conqueror restored the kingdom of Northumbria, and for 9 years the power of Oswald equaled that of Edwin. Oswald's lordship stretched as widely over Britain as that of his predecessor Edwin. In him, even more than in Edwin, men saw some faint likeness of the older emperors. Once, indeed, a writer from the land of the Picts calls Oswald emperor of the whole of Britain. In 642, Oswald led his army into East Anglia to deliver that kingdom from the terrible rule of Penda, king of Mercia. The battle was fought at Masterfeld. Oswald was defeated and slain, and for 13 years, Penda stood supreme in Britain. Oswu, younger brother of Oswald, succeeded to the kingship of Northumbria. In 655, the Northumbrians again met Penda in the field of Winward by Leeds. Penda was slain, and because of a great rain which swelled the river over which the Mercians must flee, only a remnant of them escaped. And Northumbria under Oswu stood to England as it had under Edwin and Oswald. It so continued under Egfrith, who succeeded Oswu in 670, and whose reign marks the highest pitch of Northumbrian power. Egfrith in 685 carried an expedition against the Picts, but was slain, and his army was annihilated in a battle at Fife. This delivered the central and southern kingdoms from the domination of Northumbria. Mercia immediately regained her full power over all Mid-Britain, while Wessex, under Ine from 688 to 714, gained full power over all Britain south of the Thames, and Ine's repulse of a new Mercian king in a bloody encounter at Woodnesbirth in 714 seemed to establish the threefold division of the English race between three realms of almost equal power, Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex. However, Ine in 726 made a pilgrimage to Rome. In his absence, anarchy reigned in Wessex. In this, Ethelbald, the Mercian king, saw his opportunity. He penetrated to the very heart of the West Saxon kingdom, and his siege and capture of the royal town of Somerton in 733 ended the war. For 20 years, the overlordship of Mercia was recognized by all Britain south of the Humber. And since at this time anarchy reigned in Northumbria, the kingdom of Mercia became fairly the kingdom of England. This, however, was for only a short time, for in a desperate battle at Burford in 753, a decided victory freed Wessex from the Mercian yoke. 4 years later, in 757, its freedom was maintained by a new victory at Secandum. Wessex had regained independence, but that was all. For Ethelbald, who was slain in the Battle of Secandum, was immediately succeeded by Offa, under whose long reign, 757 to 796, Mercia rose again to all but its old dominion. Offa's is the greatest name in Mercian history, and his position was as great as that of any English king before the final union of the kingdoms. In one way, it was higher than that of any of them. Offa held not only a British, but a European position. This because the mighty Charlemagne corresponded with him as with an equal. This was before Charlemagne was made emperor by the Pope, and when he manifested a disposition to treat the king of Mercia as less than an equal, war was threatened between them. And after Charlemagne became emperor of Rome, Kenwulf, Offa's successor, 797 to 819, put it clearly on record that neither the bishop of Rome nor the emperor of Rome had any jurisdiction in his realm of Mercia. By this time, Wessex had so well employed her independence as not only to have regained, but enlarged and firmly established her power over all Britain south of the Thames. This Mercia was compelled to recognize, and Kenwulf could only preserve the immediate realm of Mercia as he received it. Thus, at the close of the 8th century, the drift of the English peoples toward a national unity was in fact utterly arrested. The work of Northumbria had been foiled by the resistance of Mercia. The effort of Mercia had broken down before the resistance of Wessex. A threefold division seemed to have stamped itself upon the land, and so complete was the balance of power between the three realms which parted it, that no subjection of one to the other seemed likely to fuse the English tribes into an English people. Yet at this very time, there were taking shape in Wessex the elements which presently developed a mighty impulse toward a national unity, and which in the former part of the 10th century, with but slight checks meanwhile, culminated in the actual union of all England under only one king. Among the rival claimants of the kingship of Wessex, after the regaining of her independence in 757, was a certain Ecgbert or Egbert. The king, who was elected in 786, sought to kill him, and he was compelled to flee the kingdom entirely. He first took refuge with Offa. The king of Wessex demanded that he be surrendered. Offa refused, but as he could no longer harbor Egbert without bringing into his own affairs continual trouble, he declined to assure him further protection. Then Egbert escaped to the continent, and in 787 found refuge at the court of Charlemagne. There he went to Charlemagne's school in more senses of the word than one. In the year 800, Edburga, the wife of the king of Wessex, prepared a poisoned drink for a young friend of her husband's, but both he and her husband drank of it, and both died. Then Edburga, being obliged to flee, likewise took refuge at the court of Charlemagne. Her coming there brought to Egbert the information that the throne of Wessex was vacant. He immediately returned to Wessex and was promptly chosen to the kingship. The day of Northumberland and the day of Mercia had passed. The day of Wessex had come. The single reign of Egbert, 802 to 837, placed her forever at the head of the powers of Britain. Egbert's first exploit as king was the conquest of Cornwall, the last fragment of the British kingdom in the southwest. In 825, the king of Mercia invaded Egbert's territory, but at the battle which was fought at Ellendum, the West Saxons were victorious. This victory confirmed to Egbert all of England south of the Thames, and also encouraged the East Anglians to revolt against the king of Mercia. The East Anglians were victorious in two great battles, and this in turn so weakened the king of Mercia as to encourage Egbert to venture even across the Thames in an invasion of Mercia. This he did in 827, and the realm of Penda and Offa bowed without a struggle to its conqueror. But Egbert did not stop with the conquest of Mercia. He marched on toward the north. Northumbria had but lately been terrorized by an invasion of Danes, and unable to resist them alone, its thanes met Egbert in Derbyshire and owned the supremacy of Wessex, and with the submission of Northumbria, the work which Oswiu and Ethelred had failed to do was done, and the whole English race was for the first time knit together under a single rule. This Danish invasion of Northumbria was but a part of that great movement of the Danes in this century which reached even to France and created Normandy, and it continued in Britain until it had covered practically the whole of the land occupied by the English. Egbert defeated one host of them which invaded the land from Ireland, which gave them a check until after his death in 839. He was succeeded immediately by his son, Aethelwulf. The Danes came again and were beaten off only by years of hard fighting. But a final victory at Aclea in 851 won peace for the land through the short and uneventful reigns of his sons Athelbald and Athelbert. But the northern storm burst in full force upon England when a third son, Athelred, followed his brothers on the throne. The Northmen were now settled on the coast of Ireland and the coast of Gaul. They were masters of the sea, and from west and east alike they closed upon Britain. While one host from Ireland fell on the Scot kingdom north of the Firth of Forth, another from Scandinavia landed in 866 on the coast of East Anglia under Hubba, and marched the next year upon York. A victory over two claimants of the crown gave the pirates Northumbria, and their two armies united at Nottingham in 868 for an attack on the Mercian realm. Mercia was saved by a march of King Athelred to Nottingham, but the peace which he made there with the Northmen left them leisure to prepare for an invasion of East Anglia, whose undertaking Edmund, brought prisoner before their leaders, was bound to a tree and shot to death with arrows. With him ended the line of East Anglian under-kings, for his kingdom was not only conquered, but divided among the soldiers of the pirate host, and their leader, Guthrum, assumed its crown. By these victories of the Danes, the power of Wessex north of the Thames was again absolutely destroyed, and the loss of the subject kingdoms left Wessex face to face with the invaders. The time had now come for it to fight, not for supremacy, but for life. As yet the land seemed paralyzed by terror. With the exception of his one march on Nottingham, King Athelred had done nothing to save his under-kingdoms from the wreck. But the pirates no sooner pushed up the Thames to Reading in 871 than the West Saxons attacked on their own soil turned fiercely at bay. A desperate attack drove the Northmen from Ashdown on the heights that overlooked the Vale of Whitehorse, but their camp in the tongue of land between the Kennet and Thames proved impregnable. Athelred died in the midst of the struggle, and his brother, Alfred, who now became king, bought the withdrawal of the pirates and a few years' breathing space for his realm. It was easy for the quick eye of Alfred to see that the Northmen had withdrawn simply with the view of gaining firmer footing for a new attack. 3 years, indeed, had hardly passed before Mercia was invaded and its under-king driven oversea to make place for a tributary of the invaders. From Repton, half their host marched northward to the Tyne, while Guthrum led the rest into his kingdom of East Anglia to prepare for the next year's attack on Wessex. From 874 and onward, Northumbria and Mercia had been brought wholly under the power of the Danes. In 877, Alfred defeated one main portion of their host in his region and forced the surrender of another. In their surrender, they bound themselves by an oath to leave Wessex, which they did. But the arrival of a new horde of their kinsmen caused them to forget their oath, and at the beginning of 878, the whole double host again marched ravaging over the land. The surprise of Wessex was complete, and for a month or two the general panic left no hope of resistance. Alfred, with his small band of followers, could only throw himself into a fort raised hastily in the Isle of Athelney among the marshes of Perrott, a position from which he could watch closely the position of his foes. But with the first burst of spring, he called the Thanes of Somerset to his standard, and still gathering troops as he moved, marched through Wiltshire on the Northmen. He found their host at Edington, defeated it in a great battle, and after a siege of 14 days forced them to surrender and to bind themselves by a solemn peace, or frith, at Wedmore in Somerset. In form, the Peace of Wedmore seemed a surrender of the bulk of Britain to its invaders. All Northumbria, all East Anglia, all central England east of a line which stretched from the Thames mouth along the Lee to Bedford, thence along the Ouse to Watling Street, and by Watling Street to Chester, was left subject to the Northmen. Throughout this Danelaw, as it was called, the conquerors settled down among the conquered population as lords of the soil, thickly in northern Britain, but more thinly in its central districts, but everywhere guarding jealously their old isolation and gathering in separate heirs or armies round towns which were only linked in close confederacies. The peace had, in fact, saved little more than Wessex itself, but in saving Wessex it saved England. The spell of terror was broken, the tide of invasion turned. From an attitude of attack, the Northmen were thrown back on an attitude of defense. The whole reign of Alfred was preparation for a fresh struggle that was to wrest back from the pirates the land they had won. This peace continued till 893, during which time Alfred continually strengthened the defenses of his kingdom. He built a strong fleet and gathered all the freemen of his realm into an organized force. He had a son and a daughter, Edward and Athelflaed, who both grew up to be efficient warriors. Athelflaed was married to Athelred, an ealdorman of the old royal stock, who also was an able warrior. This gave to Alfred three strong supporters in the building up of his power of defense against the Danes. Athelflaed and Athelred, her husband, were made lord and lady of Alfred's portion of Mercia. When in 893 there was a new invasion of the land by the Danes, both by land and by sea, Alfred met their fleet and held it at bay while Edward and Athelred caught their army near the Severn and overthrew it with a vast slaughter at Buddington. And Alfred was able so well to hold his own that in 897 the latest invaders withdrew, and the Danes, who had dwelt in the land, renewed the peace which continued for 13 years. Alfred died in 901 and was succeeded by his son Edward. In 910 there was a new outbreak of the Danes inhabiting England. Athelred, the lord of Mercia, was also now dead, which left Athelflaed the ruler of Mercia. She took the field and was so successful everywhere that she won back all that had composed the full kingdom of Mercia. Edward, on his part, repulsed an inroad of another new band of Danes and brought East Anglia under his power. Athelflaed died in 918. Edward immediately annexed Mercia to his dominion and carried his arms triumphantly to the Humber. And in 924, the whole of the north suddenly laid itself at his feet. Not merely Northumbria, but the Scots and the Britons of Strathclyde chose him to father and lord. Edward the Unconquered died in 925 and was succeeded by his son Athelstan till 940, when he died and was succeeded by his son Edmund till 946, when he was killed by a robber and was succeeded by his brother Edred. Under Athelstan, Northumberland was incorporated, and the immediate realm of the one king of England reached to the fourth. Still, both he and his two successors had to fight against endless revolts and rival kings in Northumberland. The Danish land was won and lost and won back over and over again, till at last, under Edred, Northumberland was finally incorporated and ruled, sometimes by a single earl, sometimes by two of the king's appointment. With its submission in 954, the work of conquest was done. Dogged as his fight had been, the Northman at last owned himself beaten. From the moment of Edred's final triumph, all resistance came to an end. The Kingdom of England was now formed. The first half of the 10th century thus gave the West Saxon kings a position in Britain such as no English kings of any kingdom had ever held before them. Dominant in their own island, claiming and, whenever they could, exercising a supremacy over the other princes of the island, their position in the island world of Britain was analogous to the position of the Western emperors in continental Europe. It was, in fact, an imperial position. As such, it was marked by the assumption of the imperial title Monarcha, Imperator, Basileus, Augustus, and even Caesar. These titles were meant at once to assert the imperial supremacy of the English kings within their own world and to deny any supremacy over Britain on the part of either of the lords of the continental world. But one and strong and glorious as England stood in the central years of the 10th century, her unity and strength and glory were bought in no small degree by the loss of the ancient freedom of her people. In 955, Edred died and was succeeded by the two sons of his brother and predecessor, Edmund. The elder son, Edwig, received Wessex as King of England by right, while the younger, Edgar, received Northumberland and Mercia as under-king to Edwig. But in 957 the kingdom was actually divided into these two parts by the Mercians and Northumbrians, declaring Edgar full king in his own right. However, in 959 Edwig died and Edgar succeeded to the whole dominion in his own right, and under Edgar's rule the land enjoyed 16 years of unparalleled peace and of unparalleled prosperity. During his reign, no word of foreign invasion was breathed, and the two or three disturbances within the island were of slight consequence. At no time in our early history did England hold a higher position in the world in general. And when old Saxon Otto wore the crown of Rome, and West Saxon Edgar, in some sort his nephew, reigned over the island empire of Britain, the Saxon name had reached the highest point of its glory. Edgar was succeeded by his son Edward in 975, but he was allowed to reign only 4 years, for at the instigation of his stepmother, Alfthryth, he was murdered in 979, and Alfthryth's son, Athelred II, was put upon the throne and thus entered on the saddest and most shameful reign in English annals, which continued for 37 years. In the second year of his reign, 980, another invasion of the Danes flooded the land, and the flood never really ceased until all England was held by the Danes, and a Dane sat upon the throne of all England. The unready king, that is, the king without rede or counsel, seems to have been incapable of any settled or vigorous plan of action. He showed energy now and then in needless and fruitless enterprises, but under him the kingdom never showed a united front toward the common enemy. His only policy of his cowardly or traitorous advisers was the self-destroying policy of buying off the invaders with money. The invaders are met at London, at Maldon, at Exeter, with the highest valor and conduct on the part of the leaders and people of particular cities and districts. But it is always isolated cities and districts which resist. Such local efforts were naturally fruitless. The local force is either defeated by superior numbers, or, if victorious, it has, through want of concert with other parts of the kingdom, no means of following up its victory. Through a warfare like this, carried on year after year, the nation at last lost heart as well as its king. Local jealousies, hushed under the vigorous rule of earlier kings, now rose again. It is emphatically said that one shire would not help other. Under such a reign, the efforts of the best men in the land were thwarted, and the places of highest power fell to the worst men. The successive advisers of Athelred appear as a succession of traitors who sold him and his kingdom to the enemy. It was for the Witan to pass decrees, but it was for the king to put them in force, and under Athelred, nothing good was ever put in force. In 991, a new wave of the Danish flood swept upon the land. However, by this time, they were more than Danes who came. Even the Norwegian king, Olaf Tryggvason, was amongst them. In 994, another wave swept upon the devoted land. In this, the Northmen hosts were led by King Olaf of Norway and King Sweggen of Denmark. The forces of London defeated those that invaded that part of the land, but Athelred obtained peace from them by purchase with money. Yet the peace was not kept, except by a portion of them, and for 8 years the war went on by new invasions on the part of the Danes, and new payments on the part of the king, until 1002, when an attempt was made to rid England of the Danes by a general massacre on St. Brice's Day, the 13th of November. Athelred had also quarreled with Duke Richard of Normandy, but in this same year, 1002, he sealed a peace with Richard and also hoped to strengthen his kingdom by receiving in marriage Emma, the daughter of Duke Richard of Normandy. Wedding and murder, however, proved feeble defenses against Sweggen. His fleet reached the coast in 1003, and for 4 years he marched through the length and breadth of southern and eastern England, lighting his war beacons as he went in blazing homestead and town. Then for a heavy bribe he withdrew, to prepare for a later and more terrible onset. But there was no rest for the realm. The fiercest of the Norwegian Jarls took his place, and from Wessex the war extended over Mercia and East Anglia. Sweggen returned in 1013. The war was terrible but short. Everywhere the country was pitilessly harried, churches plundered, men slaughtered. With the one exception of London, there was no attempt at resistance. Oxford and Winchester flung open their gates. The thanes of Wessex submitted to the Northmen at Bath. Even London was forced at last to give way, and Athelred fled over sea to a refuge in Normandy. The Danish king was acknowledged as king, though native writers choose rather to call him tyrant over all England. Sweggen died in 1014 and was succeeded by his son Canute, a young man of 19. The English council, or Witan, however, called for the restoration of Athelred. Athelred returned, which caused a war between the two kings. In 1016, Athelred died and was succeeded by his son, Edmund, surnamed Ironside, an able general who was successful against Canute until Ealdorman Edric of Mercia's deserting him in the midst of a great battle at Assendun caused his complete overthrow. The kingdom was then divided between Edmund and Canute, Edmund taking the south and Canute the north. But Edmund died shortly afterward, and Canute, both by his power and by formal election, became king of all England, was regularly crowned as such, and ruled even as a native king. England was neither oppressed nor degraded under his rule. His government, his laws were framed after the pattern of those of the ancient kings. He sent home his Danish army, keeping only a body of chosen guards, the famous housecarls. These were the first standing army known in England, a body of picked men, Danes, Englishmen, or brave men from any quarter. Canute gradually displaced the Danes whom he had at first placed in high offices and gave them English successors. He raised an Englishman, the renowned Godwin, to a place second only to kingship, with the new title of Earl of the West Saxons. In her foreign relations, England, under her Danish king, was in no sense a dependency of Denmark. England was the center, Winchester was the imperial city, of a northern empire which rivaled those of the east and the west. Canute, it must be remembered, was chosen to the crown of England first of all, while still very young. To that crown he added the crown of Denmark, on the death or deposition of his brother Harold. He won Norway, which had revolted against his father, from its king Olaf, and he seems to have established his power over part of Sweden and other parts of the Baltic lands. But all these were acquisitions made by one who was already king of all England. They were largely won by English valor, and the complaint in Denmark and elsewhere was that Canute made his northern kingdom subordinate to England, and preferred Englishmen rather than natives to high offices in them. At home, after the first years of his reign, his rule was one of perfect peace. In 1028 he wrote, "I have vowed to God to lead a right life in all things, to rule justly and piously my realms and subjects, and to administer just judgment to all. If heretofore I have done aught beyond what was just, through headiness or negligence of youth, I am ready with God's help to amend it utterly. No royal officer, either for fear of the king or for favor of any, is to consent to injustice. None is to do wrong to rich or poor as they would value my friendship and their own well-being. I have no need that money be heaped together for me by unjust demands. I have sent this letter before me that all the people of my realm may rejoice in my well-doing. For as you yourselves know, never have I spared nor will I spare to spend myself and my toil in what is needful and good for my people." In 1031, Canute's reign over all the north was made complete by the Scotch kings doing full homage to the king of all England. Canute died in 1035. He had named as his successor in England Harthacnut, or Hardicanut, his son by Emma, the widow of Athelred, whom early in his reign he had married, though she must have been nearly twice as old as he. But there was another son named Harold, who was supported in his claims to the kingdom by Mercia and Northumberland. The West Saxons, with Godwin and Emma, in accordance with Canute's will, accepted Harthacnut. War was prevented by a decree of the National Council dividing the kingdom between the two. Harthacnut remained in Denmark, and the West Saxons deposed him and acknowledged Harold. There came also over from Normandy Alfred, the elder son of Athelred, who in 1016 had been obliged to flee the kingdom from the jealous hate of Canute. But his attempt was a complete failure. He and his companions fell into the hands of Harold. His companions were all put to death. He himself was blinded, and soon afterward he died. In 1040, Harold himself died, and Harthacnut, by right and by national choice, became king again, this time king of the whole realm. But his reign was now short, for he died in 1042. The English nation then chose Edward, the second son of Athelred, who had fled to Normandy. His monastic virtues won him the reputation of a saint and the title of the Confessor. But no man could have been less fitted to wear the crown of England in such an age. It was chiefly by the influence of Godwin that Edward had been chosen to the kingship, and Edward now married Godwin's daughter and did him further honor by appointing his sons to earldoms. Edward greatly offended the English people by bringing with him from Normandy and putting into every place that he could a great number of Norman favorites. His chief favorite was a Norman monk whom he made first Bishop of London and presently Archbishop of Canterbury. These Norman favorites soon made themselves so insolent and unbearable that Godwin and his sons, in behalf of the nation, took up arms against them. But Godwin was induced to submit his cause to the National Council, which decided against him, and he and his sons were banished. But within a year, 1050, they returned with an army. The English were now so utterly wearied with the arrogance of the king's Norman favorites that they gladly welcomed Godwin. The king mustered an army to meet him, but the army refused to fight. The National Assembly again considered Godwin's cause and banished the Norman Archbishop of Canterbury with a great company of other Normans. In 1053, the great Earl Godwin died and was succeeded in his high place in the kingdom by his son Harold. In the beginning of 1066, King Edward died while the National Assembly was in session. Edward had no children, and on his deathbed he had recommended Harold as his successor. The National Assembly accepted the recommendation, and Harold was regularly chosen and crowned King of England and reigned as Harold II. The Norman Invasion. In 1035, the death of Duke Robert of Normandy had left his son William his successor, a child of but 7 or 8 years old. He was the 6th Duke of Normandy, and by relationship was the 5th in direct descent from Rolf, or Rollo, the Danish chief who received from Charles the Simple the Duchy of Normandy. By the time that he attained to the age of 20, he had firmly fixed his authority in Normandy, and by the time he was 36, he had obtained possession of the counties of Maine and Brittany and stood first among the princes of France. In 1051, he had made a visit to King Edward of England, and ever afterward claimed that at that time Edward had promised to him the crown of England at Edward's death. He further claimed that while Edward was a child in banishment in Normandy, he had said to William that if ever he became King of England, William should be his successor. Further, about 1065, when Harold was the foremost subject in England, he had made a journey to Normandy, but by a storm was driven out of his direct course and was shipwrecked near the mouth of the Somme, in the territory of the Count of Ponthieu, who would not let him go without a ransom, and William paid the ransom, and so Harold came safely to William's court. William told him of the promise that Edward had made and asked Harold whether he would support him in his claims under the promise. Harold assented, but William asked for an oath. This, too, Harold gave. And now, in 1066, when William learned that Harold himself had received the crown of England, without any recognition or even mention of any of his claims, he determined that he would have the kingdom anyhow. He first sent an envoy to Rome to obtain the sanction of the Pope. When William had taken the oath of Harold to support him in his claims to the kingship of England under the promises of Edward, by a trick he had secured Harold's oath upon the relics of the saints. And now, when he desired the Pope's sanction of his enterprise, he urged the perjury and the awful blasphemy of Harold's course in disregarding an oath given upon the holy relics. He asked the Pope even to put all England under an interdict because of her having chosen such a man as this for king, and also because the nation had expelled the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had borne the consecration of Rome. Hildebrand was at that time archdeacon at the papal court. He approved William's claims, and by his influence the Pope also was brought to William's support. William was thus able to cloak his schemes under the guise of a crusade and to attack England alike with temporal and spiritual weapons. Feeling thus sure of his ground in the support of the papacy, William issued a proclamation that, supported by the Holy Father of Christendom, who had sent to him a consecrated banner, William, Duke of Normandy, was about to demand by force of arms his rightful inheritance of England, and that all who would serve him with spear, sword, or crossbow should be amply rewarded. At this call, gathered together all the adventurers of Western Europe. They came in crowds from Maine and Anjou, from Poitou and Brittany, from Aquitaine and Burgundy, from France and Flanders. They should have land, they should have money, they should wed Saxon heiresses, the humblest foot soldier should be a gentleman. The summer of 1066 was almost past before the preparations were complete. A large fleet had assembled at the beginning of September at the mouth of the Dive. At this same time, there was hanging over England another invasion from Norway. The King of Norway, in this same month of September, landed with a host in what is now Yorkshire, defeated the local forces, and September 24 received the submission of the territory immediately north of the Humber. Harold, marching to meet the invaders, found them September 25 and routed them at Stamford Bridge, near the city of York. In the afternoon of September 27, William, at the head of his fleet, started across the channel, and early in the day, September 28, landed at Pevensey, on the coast of Sussex. Harold, learning of this, brought his army as rapidly as possible again to the south, and October 14, with his forces of Wessex, East Anglia, and Mercia, met William and his host on the hill of Senlac, near the city of Hastings, and not a great distance from the place of his landing. At 9 o'clock, the Normans moved across the little valley with the papal banner carried in advance of the Duke. The camp of the English was fortified by a trench and a stockade, and at first the English were successful. They repulsed both the Norman horsemen and footmen, and at one time there was such danger of a panic amongst the Normans that William was obliged to tear off his helmet so that he could be readily recognized and by voice rally his troops. After a fight of 6 hours, William commanded his men to turn their backs. The English raised a cry of triumph and, breaking their ranks, rushed from their commanding position into the plain. Then the Norman cavalry wheeled around and a terrible slaughter took place. Harold fell a little before sunset, pierced by an arrow in his right eye. Under cover of the night, the remnant of the English army fled, and William's victory was complete. All of Harold's brothers had fallen with him in the battle, and of the regular royal line there was remaining but one male, a boy named Edgar, about 10 years old, the grandson of Edmund Ironside. This boy the National Council chose to the kingship, but the boy had sufficient sense to keep him from offering resistance to the greatest warrior of the age, and he himself was at the head of the deputation sent by the National Assembly to offer the crown to William. The widow of the late King Edward yielded to William and surrendered Winchester. By the National Assembly, he was now chosen king and crowned at Westminster on Christmas Day. He was thus king by the submission of the chief men, by the right of coronation, and by the absence of any other claimant. Yet he had practically the whole of the territory of his kingdom still to conquer. This, however, he accomplished with ease, never after Senlac being required to fight a single pitched battle. Yet, though so much of the realm was still unconquered, William felt so secure in his kingdom that, in the month of March, the next year, 1067, he went back to Normandy to attend to the affairs of his dominions on the continent. His lieutenants, whom he left in charge in England, made themselves so obnoxious that before the end of the year, revolts recalled William to England, and within 2 years he secured the recognition of his power throughout the whole kingdom. Early in 1070, William reviewed and dismissed his army at Salisbury. At the Easter feast of the same year, being now full king over all England, he was again solemnly crowned by legates from Rome. In 1072, he entered Scotland and received the homage of Malcolm at Abernethy. He had thus succeeded to the empire, as well as to the immediate kingdom of his West Saxon predecessors. In the next year, he employed English troops on the continent in winning back the revolted county of Maine. In 1074, he could afford to admit Edgar, the rival king of a moment, to his favor. As before stated, William laid the basis of his claim to the kingdom of England in his asserted promise of Edward that William should be his successor. And now that he had actually obtained possession of the kingdom, he held that the kingdom had been his by full right ever since the death of Edward. By this assertion, he made it to follow that all that had been done in the kingdom since the death of Edward had been illegal, that all who had fought against him were guilty of treason, that all who had sustained Harold had fought against him, and that as the General Assembly of the kingdom had sustained Harold, and had even crowned a new king after the death of Harold, the whole nation was thus involved in the crime of treason. Whoever was guilty of treason, all his lands and goods were forfeit to the crown. And since the whole kingdom was guilty of treason, all the lands and goods of all the people in the whole realm were forfeit to him, and he actually claimed all as his own. He did not remove the original owners from their land indiscriminately and everywhere. Much of the land he turned over to new owners, some he left to the possession of the original owners. But whether given to new owners or left in the possession of the original owners, everyone was obliged to receive it as the direct gift of the king, and to hold it continually subject to the king's pleasure and as the king's man. The only proof of lawful ownership was either the king's written grant, or else evidence that the owner had been put in possession by the king's order. In order to make this system thorough, William had a survey made of all the lands of the whole realm, and a census of all property and of the owners thereof. All this was recorded in a book, the value of the lands at the time the survey was made, the value of it in the time of Edward, and the value of it at the date when it was bestowed upon its latest owner by the grant of the king. In the book were recorded the numbers dwelling upon the land, whether as tenants or dependents, the amount of livestock, etc., and because the record in this book was the standard of decision upon every question or dispute as to property, and because its testimony was final in every case, that book was called Doomsday Book, from dom, meaning doom, decree, law, judgment, or decision. This record was finished in 1086, and then William gathered all the landowners of his kingdom, great and small, whether his tenants in chief or the tenants of an intermediate lord, and made them all become his men. And thus the Norman king was not only the head of the state, but also the personal lord of every man in his kingdom. This thoroughness with respect to persons and property caused the king's authority to be respected everywhere throughout the realm, and the good peace that he made in the land was such that a man might fare over his realm with a bosom full of gold. In January 1087, William went again to Normandy, especially for the purpose of settling a dispute concerning some Norman territory which the king of France had seized. In the month of August, his forces had taken the town of Mantes, and as William rode amongst the smoldering ruins, his horse stumbled and fell, by which William received an injury from which he died September 9. He left three sons. The eldest, Robert, was at the court of France. The other two, William and Henry, were with him at the time of his death. To the eldest, he left the inheritance of Normandy. To William he gave his ring and advised him to go at once to England and assume the crown. To Henry, the youngest, he bequeathed 5,000 pounds of silver. William arrived safely in England and was crowned at Westminster, September 26, 1087. He is known in history as William Rufus the Red. The Norman element of England was so opposed to him that they actually revolted. But it was in vain, for his English subjects stood so loyally by him as to render him successful against all opposition. In 1096, his brother of Normandy, desiring to go on the First Crusade, and not having sufficient funds, borrowed the needed sum from William of England, and gave Normandy as the mortgage for the repayment of the money. A part of the duchy rebelled. William went over and put down the rebellion. In 1098 and 99, he also conquered Maine. Shortly afterward, he returned to England, and August the 2nd, 1100, he was found dead in the New Forest with an arrow in his breast. Whether shot by an assassin or in accident by a hunter was never discovered. The kingdom was instantly seized by his brother Henry, surnamed Beauclerc. The Norman element of the kingdom opposed him, as they had opposed William Rufus, but the National Assembly unanimously elected him and promptly crowned him. Further, to hold the affections of his English subjects, he married a lady of English blood, Edith, the daughter of the King of Scotland, whose mother was the sister of the last King Edgar and granddaughter of King Edmund Ironside. She changed her name to Maud, or Matilda, and the shout of the English multitude when he set the crown on Matilda's brow drowned the murmur of churchman and of baron. The mockery of the Norman nobles who nicknamed the king and his spouse Godric and Godgifu was lost in the joy of the people at large. For the first time since the conquest, an English sovereign sat on the English throne. The blood of Cerdic and Alfred was to blend itself with that of Rolf and the Conqueror. Henceforth, it was impossible that the two peoples should remain parted from each other. So quick, indeed, was their union that the very name of Norman had passed away in half a century, and at the accession of Henry's grandson, it was impossible to distinguish between the descendants of the conquerors and those of the conquered at Senlac. Shortly after this, Robert returned from the Crusades, and the Norman nobles in England conspired to bring him over to contend in England for that kingdom. He did come with an army, landing at Portsmouth, but Henry was able to make with him such terms that, without fighting, a peace was settled, by which Robert recognized Henry as King of England and returned to his proper dominions on the continent. There, however, he so misgoverned his territories that they called on Henry to come over and be their king. In 1106 he went to Normandy with an army. The dispute culminated in the Battle of Tenchebrai, in which Robert was defeated and captured and was held in captivity until his death in 1134. Thus Normandy was conquered and possessed by the King of England, as 40 years before England had been conquered and possessed by William of Normandy. During the rest of Henry's reign, there was perfect peace in England, but nearly the whole time was filled with continental wars. The warfare between France and England, of which there had been only a glimpse in the days of Rufus, now began in earnest. And from the entanglements, intrigues, and war in France, which was now begun by Henry, England never found herself free for 347 years. In 1120, as Henry was returning with his forces from Normandy to England, his only son, William, full of merriment and wine, and with rowers and steersmen mad with drink, had barely left harbor when his ship struck a rock and instantly sank. One terrible cry ringing through the silence of the night was heard by the royal fleet, but it was not till the morning that the fatal news reached the king. Stern as he was, Henry fell senseless to the ground and rose never to smile again. This left the son of his captive brother Robert as the true heir to Henry's dominions, alike of England and Normandy. But Henry determined not to allow him to be his successor. Henry had a daughter, Maud or Matilda, who had been married to the Emperor Henry V, but who on his death had returned to England and her father's house. And although, so far in English history, the reign of a woman had been unknown, yet Henry decided that Maud should succeed him upon the throne of England. Accordingly, while he lived, he forced priests and nobles to swear allegiance to Maud as their future mistress, and chose for her husband Geoffrey, the son of the Count of Anjou in France. In 1135 Henry died, but the arrangement which he had made for the succession of Maud to the throne was disregarded by the National Assembly, and Stephen was chosen King of England. Stephen was the grandson of William the Conqueror, and with the rest of the chief men of England, had done homage and sworn allegiance to Maud as the successor of Henry. All this, however, was disregarded, and without opposition, Stephen became King of England. One great reason why the agreement with Maud was not carried into effect was that for her to be queen would cause that Geoffrey of Anjou would practically be ruler, and he an utter foreigner, and this neither English nor Normans would have. At the time all this occurred, Maud was not in England, but was with her husband in Anjou, and when they heard of these proceedings in England, Geoffrey seized Normandy. With this added prestige, and with an army, Maud invaded England in 1139. Stephen was defeated and captured at Lincoln in 1141, and Maud was received throughout the land as its lady. They would not use the word queen. However, she was not crowned. She offended the city of London, which rose in arms against her. In exchange of prisoners, Stephen had been released. For 11 years there was civil war, a time of utter anarchy and havoc and chaos of pillage and bloodshed. Then, in 1153, an agreement was made between King Stephen and Maud's son Henry, who was now Duke of Normandy. By this agreement, Stephen was to reign as long as he lived, and then Henry should have the kingdom. Stephen died the next year, and the agreement was fully carried out as to Henry, and so he came to his kingdom without any opposition or any further confusion. Henry II was now, by right from his grandfather Henry I, King of England and Duke of Normandy. In France, as the heir of his father Geoffrey, he was lord of the counties of Anjou, Maine, and Touraine. And through his brother also of Brittany, and now by marriage to Eleanor, the Duchess of Poitou, Aquitaine, and Gascony, he received with her these three counties, the principal portion of southern Gaul. Besides all this, one of the first events of his reign was the granting of a bull by the Pope giving to him Ireland. Thus, in the reign of Henry II, the British Empire embraced Ireland, all of England and Wales south of the Forth, and all of western and central France, from the English Channel to the border of Spain. In ruling over a vast number of distinct states, widely differing in blood, language, and everything else, ruling over all without exclusively belonging to any, Henry II, King, Duke, and Count of all the lands from the Pyrenees to the Scottish border, was the forerunner of the Emperor Charles V. His father, Geoffrey, Count of Anjou, habitually wore in his helmet a sprig of broomcorn, called in the native tongue Planta Genista, from which he received the nickname of Plantagenet, which clung to his house. And so Henry, the second of England, became the first of the Plantagenets who ruled England for 331 years, from 1154 to 1485. Henry II died in 1189 and was succeeded by his son Richard, surnamed Coeur de Lion, Heart of Lion. At his accession, Richard was absent from England in his mother's possession in southern Gaul, and during his whole reign of 10 years he was in England but twice, both times merely for the purpose of being crowned, first immediately on his accession in the autumn of 1189, second in 1194 on his return from the Crusades. In 1190 Richard went on his crusade, and to obtain the money for his expenses he sold everything that he could sell, short of the very kingdom itself. He put up the crown of domains, he sold the public offices, he sold earldoms, he sold the claim which his father Henry had asserted to the right of homage for the crown of Scotland. "I would sell London if I could find a chapman," he exclaimed. Richard's presence chamber was a market overt, in which all that the king could bestow, all that could be derived from the bounty of the crown or imparted by the royal prerogative, was disposed of to the best chapman. Though on his crusade Richard was 4 years absent from his dominions, he was in Palestine only about 16 months, June 8, 1191 to October 9, 1192. While there, he had dealt a kick to the Duke of Austria for his refusing to work on the walls of Ascalon. And now on his return, as he was trying to make his way in disguise through Austria, he was detected when near Vienna and was made prisoner by the Duke of Austria, December 21, 1192, who sold him to the Emperor, who was also ready to sell him, but there was no buyer. In hope of release, Richard agreed to pay an annual tribute to the emperor, resigned his crown to the emperor, and received it back as vassal to the overlord of Christendom. Yet he was kept prisoner till March 8, 1194, when he was released on a ransom of what would be now about $1 million. He went at once to England, landing March 12, and notwithstanding the heavy drain upon the people to pay his ransom, without any recompense whatever, he forcibly resumed the lands which he had sold and turned out the officers who had purchased their places to enable him to make his crusade. His stay in England was brief. He sailed away March 11, 1194, and never saw England again. He was mortally wounded by an arrow while besieging Chaluz in a war with King Philip II of France, and died 12 days afterward, April 6, 1199. He was immediately succeeded by his brother John. John, surnamed Lackland because his father, with all his vast possessions, left him no land, was crowned King of England on Ascension Day, May 27, 1199. There was a nearer heir in the person of Arthur, the grandson of Henry II, through his third son Geoffrey, while John was so far removed as to be the fifth son of Henry. But Arthur, being a boy of only 12 years, while John was a man of 32 years, John was chosen as the one better able to discharge the responsibilities of kingship at that time. All the continental possessions of England likewise recognized John, except the three counties of Maine, Touraine, and Anjou. These openly espoused the claims of Arthur. King Philip of France stood with these in supporting Arthur, this, however, to promote his own designs in excluding, if possible, England from any possessions within the limits of what should be France. This brought on a war. John went at once to Normandy to defend his interests on the continent. Philip invaded Normandy, besides putting garrisons in the three counties of Maine, Touraine, and Anjou. When the war had continued 8 months, a truce was arranged about the 1st of March, 1200. John spent the months of March and April in England, and the 1st of May he returned to Normandy. The war was taken up again, but on May 23 a peace was concluded. Philip abandoned the interests of Arthur with respect to Maine, Touraine, and Anjou, but in the peace it was arranged that Arthur should receive Brittany as a fief from John, and that Philip's son Louis should marry John's niece Blanche of Castile. While passing through his province of Aquitaine, John saw a beautiful woman, already betrothed to a noble, and he secured a divorce from his own wife and persuaded this lady to marry him. This stirred up to vengeance against John, the noble, Hugh, Count of La March. He incited an insurrection in John's possessions on the continent. He was secretly supported by Philip, and in 2.5 years, Normandy, Anjou, Maine, and Touraine were lost to England. Arthur had joined in the insurrection, had been captured, and was assassinated at the direction of John, if not by the very hand of John himself. In 1203, the Estates of Brittany sent a deputation to Philip to demand justice against John. John, as Duke of Normandy, was summoned to appear before a court of his peers in France, and as a vassal of the King of France. John's envoy asked for a safe conduct. Philip answered that he should come unmolested. Then John's envoy wanted to know whether he could be assured of a safe return. Philip replied that he should have safe return if the judgment of his peers acquitted him. John's envoy then remarked that, since John was King of England as well as Duke of Normandy, the Duke of Normandy could not come without the King of England's coming, and declared that the barons of England would not permit their king to run the risk of death or imprisonment. Philip, however, insisted that the Duke of Normandy should come, because, as such, he was truly the vassal of the King of France. John did not go, and for his contumacy, the court decreed that whereas John, Duke of Normandy, in violation of his oath to Philip, his lord, has murdered the son of his elder brother, a homager of the crown of France, and near kinsman to the king, and has perpetrated the crime within the seigneury of France, he is found guilty of felony and treason, and is therefore adjudged to forfeit all the lands he has held by homage. This allowed Philip to assert legal claim to all the English possessions in France, and he at once entered Normandy and occupied the strongholds with his troops. But this the Normans did not like, and they appealed to John to come to their rescue. But against this, England protested, because she thought the time was come when her wealth should no longer be dissipated in Normandy, when her language should be spoken by those who ruled over her, when her laws should be administered by those who abided among her people, and when her church should be upheld by those who had no foreign bishoprics and abbeys. As a consequence, all the continental possessions of England except Aquitaine were now lost, and from the lordship of a vast empire that stretched from the Tyne to the Pyrenees, John saw himself reduced at a blow to the realm of England. Next, in 1207, John fell into a quarrel with Rome. March 24, 1208, England was placed under an interdict, which John resisted for 5 years, when, in 1213, to the interdict, the excommunication of John was added, and England was given by the Pope to Philip of France. Philip gathered a fleet and an army with which to go and take possession of England. John surrendered to the Pope and took an oath of fealty as the vassal of Rome. Then the Pope forbade Philip any further designs upon England. Philip determined to take England anyhow, but his vassal, the Count of Flanders, refused to support him. This caused war. John supported Flanders, and Philip's fleet was destroyed. Next, supported by the Pope and the Emperor, the Count of Flanders and the Earl of Boulogne, John went with an army to punish Philip further. A great battle was fought at Bouvines. John and his allies were completely overthrown and concluded an ignominious truce with Philip and returned to England October 1214. The people of England had long borne with the numberless wickednesses of John, but when he made the realm of England a fief and the King of England a vassal of the Pope, they could bear with him no longer. John himself wrote to the Pope that, "Whereas before we were disposed to subject ourselves and our realm to your dominion, the earls and barons of England never failed in their devotion to us. Since then, however, and as they publicly avow for that reason, they have been in continual and violent rebellion against us." Because of this attitude of his nobles, when John returned now from France, he came with an army of mercenaries, with the avowed intent that by this power he would be for the first time king and lord of England. But there were now two eminent persons among many other bold and earnest churchmen and laity who saw that the time was come when no man should be king and lord in England with a total disregard of the rights of other men, a time when a king should rule in England by law instead of by force, or rule not at all. Stephen Langton, the Archbishop, and William, Earl of Pembroke, were the leaders and at the same time moderators in the greatest enterprise that the nation had yet undertaken. It was an enterprise of enormous difficulty. The Pope was now in friendship with the king, and this might influence the great body of ecclesiastics. The royal castles were in possession of the mercenary soldiers. The craft of John was as much to be dreaded as his violence. But there was no shrinking from the duty that was before these patriots. They moved on steadily in the formation of a league that would be strong enough to enforce their just demands, even if the issue were war between the crown and the people. The bishops and barons were the great council of the nation. Parliament, including the commons, was not as yet, though not far distant. The doctrine of divine right was the invention of an age that sought to overthrow the ancient principle of an elective monarchy, in which hereditary claims had indeed a preference, but in which the sovereign is appointed to protect his subjects in their lives, properties, and laws, and for this very end and purpose has the delegation of power from the people. The nobles met at St. Edmundsbury, and after duly considering the situation, November 20, 1214, they solemnly swore to withdraw their allegiance from John if he should resist their claims to just government. They had not only public wrongs to redress, but the private outrages of the king's licentiousness were not to be endured by the class of high-born knights whom he insulted through their wives and daughters. From St. Edmundsbury they marched to London, where the king had shut himself up in the temple. When their deputies came into his presence, he first despised their claims, and then asked for delay. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the Earl of Pembroke, and the Bishop of Ely guaranteed that a satisfactory answer should be given before Easter. The king employed the time in the endeavor to propitiate the church by promising a free election of bishops. He took the cross and engaged to wage war with the infidels. He sent to Rome to implore the aid of the Pope in his quarrel. And the Pope came to his aid and commanded Langton to exercise his authority to bring back the king's vassals to their allegiance. At Easter, the barons, with a large force, assembled at Stamford. John was at Oxford, and Langton and Pembroke were with him. They were sent by the king to ascertain the demands of their peers, and these messengers or mediators brought back Magna Carta. This was a code of laws expressed in simple language, embodying two principles. The first, such limitations of the feudal claims of the king as would prevent their abuse. The second, such specifications of the general rights of all freemen as were derived from the ancient laws of the realm, however these rights had been neglected or perverted. It demanded no limitation of the regal power which had not been acknowledged in theory by every king who had taken a coronation oath. It made that oath, which had been regarded as a mere form of words, a binding reality. It defined in broad terms of practical application the essential difference between a limited and a despotic monarchy. It preserved all the proper attributes of the kingly power while it guarded against the king being a tyrant. In it, the king was required to declare the great principle of the supremacy of the law of the realm in the words, "No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or deceased, or outlawed, or banished, or any otherwise destroyed, nor will we pass upon him, nor send upon him, unless by the legal judgment of his peers, or by the law of the land. To no man will we sell, to no man will we deny or delay, right or justice." The charter was a long document. The archbishop read it to the king slowly and solemnly, item by item. John went into a furious passion, exclaiming, "Why do they not ask for my kingdom? I will never grant such liberties as will make me a slave." Langton and Pembroke took back to the nobles this, the king's answer. The barons proclaimed themselves the army of God and Holy Church, and marched upon London, which they entered May 22, 1215. The citizens of London having already agreed to make common cause with them. There were further negotiations. The barons were immovable, and John yielded and agreed to a meeting. The meeting was appointed to be held June 15, on an island in the Thames, between Windsor and Staines, near a marshy meadow by the riverside, the meadow of Runnymede, Runmed, the mead or meadow of council. The king encamped on one bank of the river, the barons covered the flat of Runnymede on the other. Their delegates met on the island between them, but the negotiations were a mere cloak to cover John's purpose of unconditional submission. The Great Charter was discussed and agreed to in a single day. However, this was not all. The barons had not yet finished with John. They next required that he should agree to articles by which there should be assured the means of carrying into effect the provisions of the charter. 25 barons were to be chosen by the barons assembled to maintain the observance of the peace and liberties granted and confirmed, so that if the king or his officers violated any of the conditions, 4 out of 25 barons so chosen might petition for redress of the grievance, and if not redressed within 40 days, the cause being laid before the rest of the 25, they together with the community of the whole kingdom shall distrain and distress us all the ways possible, namely, by seizing our castles, lands, possessions, and in any other manner they can, till the grievance is redressed according to their pleasure, saving harmless our own person and those of our queen and children, and when it is redressed, they shall obey us as before. It was further required that the charter should not only be published throughout the whole country, but sworn to at every 100 mote and town mote, by order from the king. When these new demands were made, John was more angry than ever. He cried out, "They have given me 24 overkings," and flung himself on the floor, gnawing sticks and straw in his impotent rage. But it was all in vain. The nobles were inflexible, and John was obliged to sign all that they required. No sooner was it all over, however, and the respective parties had separated and the forces dispersed, then John let himself loose to take vengeance on the whole kingdom, in all of which he was still zealously supported by the Pope, who issued a bull excommunicating the barons and annulling the charter. England rejected the excommunication and maintained the charter. But by the bull, John counted himself free from his oaths to the nobles, with full right to punish the whole people. Wherever he marches, his force is to be tracked by fire and blood. The country was overrun by his fierce mercenaries. He marched to the north with the determination to recover his authority by the terrors of a widespread desolation, without one passing thought of justice or mercy. As he entered Scotland, in revenge for the alliance which its king, Alexander II, had formed with the barons, he burned the abbeys without distinction, and having rested at a village, set fire with his own hand when he departed in the morning to the house in which he had slept the previous night. In the south, the same work of terror went forward under the command of John's illegitimate brother, the Earl of Salisbury. The barons despaired of their cause, for the people fled before these hellhounds, abandoning home and property rather than perish under the hands of relentless torturers. Their leaders came at last to a desperate resolution. They offered the crown to Louis, the eldest son of the King of France. This desperate step, of course, was fraught with more war, yet it was certain that no war could be worse than were the miseries which John was inflicting upon the kingdom without war. Louis of France landed in England May 30, 1216. Many of John's mercenaries were Frenchmen, and when their own prince came into England, they not only refused to fight against him, but actually went over to him in such numbers that John dared not meet him. Louis soon reached London, where he was welcomed. The barons and citizens paid him homage. he swearing to govern justly, to defend them against their enemies, and to restore them to their rights and possessions. Everything was in his favor, but he destroyed all his good prospects by bestowing upon Frenchmen English honors and possessions. But the whole situation was presently relieved by the death of John. He was attacked with a fever, in addition to which he gorged himself with a surfeit of peaches and new cider, and as a consequence died October 18, 1216. Though the nobles had invited Louis of France to be king of England, he had so offended that they now rejected him and chose to be King John's son, Henry, a boy of 10 years, who was crowned King Henry III at Gloucester, October 28, 1216. Louis, however, defended his claims to the crown. There was war for 2 years in which he was defeated on both land and sea. He then willingly agreed to resign his claims and withdraw to France upon the payment to him of £5,000 to meet his necessities. While Henry III was so young, the kingdom was governed by a regency till 1227, when he declared himself of age and began immediately to imitate his father John. He rejected the charter and its appendices, which John had signed, and instead of all that declared, "Whensoever and wheresoever, and as often as it may be our pleasure, we may declare, interpret, enlarge, or diminish the aforesaid statutes and their several parts by our own free will, and as to us shall seem expedient for the security of us and our land." But he, as John, was firmly met by the kingdom's insistence upon the right of the people and the supremacy of the law. In answer to Henry's pronunciamento, an English judge, Bracton, set the voice of English law in words worthy of everlasting remembrance. "The king must not be subject to any man, but to God and the law, for the law makes him king. Let the king therefore give to the law what the law gives to him, dominion and power, for there is no king where will and not law bears rule." Again, "The king can do nothing on earth, being the minister of God, but what he can do by law." And yet again, "He reckons as superior to the king not only God and the law by which he is made king, but his court of earls and barons, for the former are so styled as associates of the king, and whoever has an associate has a master, so that if the king were without a bridle, that is, the law, they ought to put a bridle upon him." Upon this it has been well observed, "Let no Englishman who lives under the rule of law and not of will forget that this privilege has been derived from a long line of forefathers, and that although the eternal principles of justice depend not upon the precedents of ages, but may be asserted some day by any community with whom a continued despotism has made them native and to the manner born, we have the security that the old tree of liberty stands in the old earth, and that a short-lived trunk has not been thrust into a new soil, to bear a green leaf or two and then to die." Henry III reigned 53 years, and the whole reign is remarkable for the constitutional contest between the king and the people upon the great question as to whether just government is by law or by arbitrary and despotic will. His reign is also remarkable for the fact that history presents him in scarcely any other light than that of an extortioner or a beggar. There were no contrivances for obtaining money so mean or unjust that he disdained to practice them, and the Pope sustained him in it all, and had more than an equal share of the spoil. Thus, both he and the Pope incurred not only the antagonism of the nobles, but the disrespect of the common people everywhere. Says a writer of the time in 1252, "During all this time, angry feelings were aroused, and hatred increased against the Pope and the King, who favored and abetted each other in their mutual tyranny, and all, being in ill humor, called them the disturbers of mankind. Matters reached such a pass in 1257 that the nobles took another step in constitutional government. The Parliament met at Westminster May the 2nd, the barons clad each in complete armor. As the king entered, there was a clatter of swords, and Henry, looking around in alarm, said, "Am I a prisoner?" "No, sir," said Roger Bigod, "but your foreign favorites and your prodigality have brought misery upon the realm. Wherefore we demand that the powers of government be delegated to a committee of bishops and barons, who may correct abuses and enact good laws." To this demand the king was obliged to submit, and on June 11, Parliament met at Oxford to formulate what had been demanded. It was enacted that four knights should be chosen by the votes of the freeholders in each country, who should submit all breaches of law and justice to a parliament, to be called together regularly thrice in each year, that the sheriffs of the counties should be chosen by the freeholders, and that the great office of state should be reappointed. This was but carrying into effect the provisions of Magna Carta and its securities which John had signed at Runnymede. And Henry, like John, after having sworn to it all, obtained a dispensation from the Pope to violate it, and told the Committee of Council in 1261 that he should rule without them. However, in 1262, after making a blustering show of war, he yielded and again agreed to observe the law. In 1264, however, he broke loose again, and the difference this time did bring on a war. Henry was defeated, a parliament was assembled on a more democratic basis than any which had been ever summoned since the foundation of the monarchy, to whose laws Henry was again required to submit. Henry III died November 16, 1272, and was succeeded by his son Edward, who, at the time, was absent in the Crusades. And it was not till 1274 that he arrived in England, August 3, and on August 19 he and his queen were crowned at Westminster. In 1282, Wales revolted, and Edward was obliged to make war there for 2 years before it was subdued. There, April 25, 1284, his first son was born, who was named Edward, and was given the title Prince of Wales, which is the origin of the title in the royal family of England. Edward I also resisted constitutional government, especially in the matter of raising taxes. But under the leadership of the two great earls, Roger Bigod of Norfolk and Humphrey Bowen of Hereford and Essex, the nobles of the kingdom, called upon the sheriffs to levy no more taxes till the charters were confirmed without any insidious reservation of the rights of the crown. Edward yielded, and the statute of the confirmation of the charter was accepted by the king. From that day, the 10th of October, 1297, the sole right of raising supplies has been invested in the people. This most salutary power, which is the greatest of the many distinctions between a limited and a despotic monarchy. Next, Edward set up a claim to be sovereign lord of the land of Scotland. This brought on a war in 1296, which continued for 23 years, far beyond his death, which occurred July 7, 1307. He was immediately succeeded by his son Edward, who was 23 years old. Edward II carried on the war with Scotland until 1323, when on May 10 a truce of 13 years was concluded. In the first year of his reign, Edward had married Isabella, the daughter of the King of France. In 1323, Isabella entered into an intrigue with Lord Roger Mortimer, which ended only in their murdering of the king. The murder, however, was preceded by his imprisonment, the declaring of his son Edward king at the age of 15, January 7, 1327, the deposition of Edward II, January 13, the proclamation of the accession of Edward III, January 24, and his crowning, January 29. Only 4 years of the truce between England and Scotland had passed when the King of Scotland, Robert Bruce, broke the truce and invaded England. But in 1328, a peace was concluded in which England recognized the independence of Scotland under Bruce, and the peace was sealed by the marriage of the sister of Edward to the son of Bruce. In 1328 had died Charles IV, King of France, leaving no direct heir. The throne was taken by a cousin, Philip of Artois. Edward's mother was the sister of Charles, and therefore, as Charles's nephew and nearer of kin than was Philip, Edward of England claimed the throne of France. The French law was that a woman could not inherit the throne, but Edward asserted the claim that, though women were excluded, the law did not exclude the son of a woman who, if she had been a man, would have inherited. When Charles IV had died, Edward had presented his claim. In 1332, Robert Bruce died, and John Balliol, who had done homage to Edward II for the kingdom, now attempted to take it from Bruce's young heir. Edward III favored Balliol, and the King of France aided young David, the son of Bruce. And this aiding of Scotland by the rival King of France against the King of England and his ally was, by Edward III, made the ground for commencing a great war for the purpose of asserting his pretensions to the crown of France. The King of France was just then at war with the people of Flanders. Edward III helped the Flemings, and they proclaimed him King of France. In 1337, Edward boldly assumed the title of King of France and prepared to enforce his claim at the sword's point. And thus began the Hundred Years' War between England and France, which continued about 120 years through the rest of the reign of Edward III to 1337, through the reign of Richard II to 1399, that of Henry IV to 1413, that of Henry V to 1422, and into the reign of Henry VI till 1458. The Hundred Years' War was barely ended when a civil war, the Wars of the Roses, began between the House of York and the House of Lancaster, which continued for 35 years through the reigns of Edward IV, Edward V, Richard III, till the death of Richard III, the last of the Plantagenets, and the crowning of Henry VII, the first of the Tudors, on Bosworth Field, August 22, 1485. Though the Wars of the Roses were thus ended, peace did not come to the kingdom, for there were insurrections and pretenders to the throne which kept the kingdom in a constant turmoil for 15 years. In the last 8 years of the reign of Henry VII, 1501 to April 21, 1509, there was neither revolts nor wars in the kingdom. Henry VII had two sons, Arthur, born 1486, and Henry in 1491. When Arthur was 4 years old, a marriage was arranged for him with a girl of 5 years, Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. In the year 1499, when the children were aged 12 and 13 respectively, the marriage ceremony was performed, first by proxy while Catherine was in Spain, and again in their own proper persons, November 6, 1501, when Catherine arrived in England. In January 1502, a treaty of perpetual peace was made between England and Scotland. This treaty was sealed by the marriage of Margaret, the daughter of Henry VII of England, to James IV, the King of Scotland. In April of the same year occurred the death of Arthur, the husband of Catherine, and heir apparent to the throne. The two kings, however, Henry and Ferdinand, immediately arranged that Henry's remaining son, Henry, should be married to Arthur's young widow, Catherine. It took a year satisfactorily to settle the terms and to get a dispensation from the Pope making the marriage legal, so that it was not till 1503 that the contract was actually completed by a ceremonial in which a person was appointed to object that the marriage was unlawful, and another to defend it as good and effectual in the law of Christ's church. To this contract, young Henry was opposed, and before he reached the age of 15, he protested in legal form against the contract, which had been made during his nonage. Henry VII died April 21, 1509, and the next day began the reign of his young son Henry, 8th of the name. June 7 following, Henry and Catherine were publicly married by the Archbishop of Canterbury and were crowned at Westminster the 24th of the same month.